In this hour, folks, we welcome back to the program a guest who's been with us a couple of times now. Most recently, we think it was just this past spring. His name is James Loewen, and he's an historian, probably best known for a book that he wrote that came out a number of years ago but is still selling briskly, a book titled Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong. It is a book that takes a look at some of the most widely used high school history texts and some of the inaccuracies therein. He was here not very long ago, and we talked about his more recent book, which is titled Lies Across America, which attempts to do the same thing, looking at historic markers and monuments, some of them that are just plain wrong, and some that engage in what we today would call spin. He's here visiting the campus, spending some time in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall, where he's spending a lot of time, I'm sure, talking with students. And we're happy to have him back here. When we heard he was going to be here, we just said, yes, we'd like to have him back on the show just because we think he's a pretty interesting fellow to talk with. And questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that you can use no matter where you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks again for being here.
Well, it'll be my pleasure, I'm sure.
How did you get started in all of this?
I'm not even a historian. I'm a sociologist. I shouldn't say I'm not even a historian, I guess. I am a sociologist, and pridefully so. So my very first full-time teaching job was at Tougaloo College in Mississippi, just north of Jackson. Tougaloo is a 99% black college. And I was teaching the required courses in sociology that I needed to teach, but I also got dragged into service to teach a course called the Freshman Social Science Seminar. And this was a course that Tougaloo used to replace the old Western Civ requirement, which has since been dropped by every other college in America, I think. And it introduced students to sociology, anthropology, econ, poli-sci, psych. And it did this in the context of African-American history. Second semester started, I had a new group of students. I wanted them to talk, not just me. So when you're in that context, you're, of course, in the same chronology as American history, and second semester usually, and did, in fact, start with Reconstruction. So I asked my students, what's Reconstruction? What is that period? 16 out of 17 of them said, well, that was the period right after the Civil War, when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control. Well, my little heart sank, because there's three direct misstatements of fact, lies, if you will, in that sentence. Blacks never took over the government of the southern states at Reconstruction or any other time. All of the southern states had white governors throughout the period. All but one had white legislative majorities. Second of all, the Reconstruction governments did not screw up. They wrote the best state constitutions that the southern states have ever had. They started public school systems for both races. Mississippi had not had any system for whites, and it had, of course, been illegal for blacks to learn to read and write. So they had had no schools at all. They did various other things, and so it wasn't then that whites had to take control at the end of it. Instead, white racist Democrats, and we have to remember that the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy in the 19th century. It's reversed in the last few years. So the Democratic Party, using KKK tactics, and indeed it was the original Ku Klux Klan, took over. And so this made me aware. I thought, here's a whole bunch of black students learning history in then segregated black schools from black teachers, and they've learned white history, and biased white history, inaccurate history. Can't be good for you. It's terrible. So that's when I became aware that history can be a weapon, that it can be used against you, and that it had been used against my students. That's what got me started. So since then, I've kind of been a sociologist of history. I look over this field and I say, what are they saying to us now? What are they saying to us at historic sites? What are they saying to us in American history classes? And so on.
When you look at the problems that you have found with, particularly with history textbooks, and maybe more in a larger sense with teaching of history, is it more the case that we that it's a case of carelessness, or is it willful misstatement?
Some of each. I'll give you an example of each. I was talking. When I was writing Lies, my teacher told me one of the things I did, besides reading intensively 12 high school history textbooks, A Fate Worse Than Death, was I interviewed a bunch of their authors and editors. So I was interviewing a full professor of history at Columbia who wrote at least two such textbooks, one of which was in my sample of 12. And I asked him how come in his textbook he never, although he gives a considerable amount of space to the Pilgrims and the whole settlement in Massachusetts in 1620 and thereafter, really, until past 1630 when the Puritans come in, and he never talked about the huge plague that swept through Massachusetts in about 1617, 2 or 3 years before the Pilgrims got there. And it made all the difference. The Pilgrims were very aware of this. It's one of the reasons, probably, that they chose to settle in Massachusetts, because it meant that there was vacant land and there was an absence, a relative absence, of Indians to attack them. And he replied to me, honestly, he said, "I didn't know about it. I didn't know about it until just now." And he then wrote a book, this is John Garrity, called 1001 Things Everybody Needs to Know About American History, or something like that. And this plague was, I think, number 6. So, I mean, he obviously thinks it's important. He learned about it from me, and he put it in his new book. That would be just accidental then. On the other hand, I interviewed Mark Lytle of the team of Davidson and Lytle, who have written at least 3 American history textbooks, one of which was in my sample. Now, these guys also wrote a book called After the Fact. And After the Fact, it's a good book. The title alone is a pun. Historians write after the fact, and we also, or they, go after the fact. And this book is aimed at college history majors, probably, and it argues that there are some 10 or 20 topics that need to be treated in detail, that they do treat in detail, and one of them is the My Lai Massacre. And this is just an example of all kinds of things I could pick on from this book. Well, in fact, I won't even deal with it. Let me switch back to the plague. One of them is the plague, exactly the plague we've just been talking about. Very important, he says. And furthermore, it stands for a whole class of plagues. There were some 70 or 80 plagues from the first Spanish settlement in Florida to 1918 that devastated Native Americans. So they treat that importantly in After the Fact. What do they have about it in their textbook? Nothing, not one mention. So I asked him, how come? You know, how come he leaves stuff like that out? Because he knew about it. And he said, quote, "Well, what they wanted and what we gave them was McDonald's history." And I said, "McDonald's history?" And he said, "Yes. If it had any flavor, it wouldn't sell." Now, I don't actually think McDonald's is that bad, but certainly that sentence indicates that he sold out. So that would be deliberate distortion, leaving out stuff that he knows is not only important, but that he claims is critical to the understanding of the American past, and he keeps high school students from knowing it.
Hmm. And I guess, I don't know if this is peripheral or connected, but it gets me thinking about the very point that you make right at the beginning of the introduction of Lies My Teacher Told Me, which is that high school students say, you know, if you ask them what's their least favorite subjects.
History wins.
Yep. Now, of course, if you'd asked me in high school, it would have been math, but that's why I'm now in public radio, and I'm not a doctor. But it seems that people really, you know, have this strong dislike for history, and that must have something to do with the experiences that they've had in history classes up to that point.
Sure.
The way it's taught, the kind of books that they use.
Well, I often claim that Lies My Teacher Told Me could have been subtitled Revenge Against Coach DeMolin, because Coach DeMolin was my history teacher. And all too common in Illinois, and even more common in the South, especially in Texas, coaches get assigned to teach history. Now, Coach DeMolin didn't give a damn about history. He knew, furthermore, that he was not going to get rehired or fired on the basis of how he taught history. He was going to get rehired or fired on the basis of the basketball team's one-loss record at MacArthur High School in Decatur, Illinois, where I went to high school. And so all he did was stay ahead of us in the book. In fact, I'm not even sure if he read the book. And he would have us do the interminable 50 or 60 questions at the end of each chapter. We'd write them up, we'd hand them in, and he'd hand them back to us, probably not even having read them. And then we have quizzes that were based on those same kind of, I call this twig history, because it's not only missing the forest for the trees. He's not even teaching trees. He's teaching and testing on twigs, tiny little facts that we're supposed to remember. And sometimes even those facts are, as I prove maybe, completely wrong. Well, this is just so boring, and this is so common across the U.S., that students who take history in courses like this never want to touch it again in college. Now, they're interested in history. I mean, look at the popularity of Dances with Wolves or Ken Burns' series on the Civil War, most popular series ever been on public television. Mm-hmm. So Americans are interested in history, but they are bored to tears by their high school history courses and their high school history textbooks.
Well, this raises a couple of questions, and I'll maybe try and ask both of them. But the first one is, what it says to me, sadly enough, is that we as a country don't think that history is important. We don't think that history matters.
I think that we actually do, but we have a twisted version or vision of what we should do with students, with young people. And I actually think it hasn't been thought out very well. I think if we gave it more attention, we wouldn't necessarily have this vision, and that's why I'm trying to write Lies My Teacher Told Me and Lies Across America. I think that what we somehow believe is that if we don't just treat our young people with contempt, if we don't kind of give them this nationalist, boring, everything was always great treatment of American history, then somehow they'll end up growing up and be a threat to the country. They'll be un-American. And actually, what it causes them to do, they don't grow up and believe that Christopher Columbus was a great guy, and George Washington was a great guy, and Abraham Lincoln was a great guy, and so on. I know because I have asked hundreds and hundreds of them when they're first-year students of mine in college to name their heroes in history, and many people write none, which is pretty nihilist, or they write my grandmother, and then they tell me why their grandmother's a hero of theirs, but I've never had a student say Columbus. I've never had a student say Washington. So what they include, or what they infer instead from such history courses is not that the American past is all wonderful. No, they infer that history courses are not a serious place to discuss the American past, and they just go through the motions.
The other question that came to mind, and it was in my mind before, but certainly when you talk about the fact that people love Dances with Wolves, variety of places that people get their history education from, the history classroom and history textbook, only one, and maybe not the most important one. Where do you think do most people learn what they know about history?
I think they do get a lot of it from historical novels, from movies. Now, a lot of people are reasonably sophisticated. I mean, I've asked students, for instance, did they believe the Rambo movies about Vietnam? And they did not. I think the Rambo movies, though, come across as adventure flicks rather than as serious works, whereas I think Dances with Wolves and JFK and, for that matter, Gone with the Wind come across as more serious historical novels in the case of Gone with the Wind and then historical films in the case of all three of those. And I have had a student, for instance, tell me, I'm glad you wrote this book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. This is before she read it. But she said, because I learned all kinds of bad stuff that wasn't true in high school. And I asked her that. You know, I'm always interested in such a student. And I say, well, great. What did you learn? And she said, well, I learned that Reconstruction, for instance, wasn't so bad, that they set up schools and so on. And then I saw Gone with the Wind, and I learned the truth about Reconstruction. So, you know, and she's not alone. Gone with the Wind is, in fact, by far the most popular novel in the history of the country, and certainly in the 20th century. I actually know from an American Library Association poll done in 1986 that it is the most, the American Library Association asked its patrons on the occasion of its 100th anniversary to name your favorite book in the library. There have been over 100 million, probably over 300 million books published in the United States. Gone with the Wind not only won, but Gone with the Wind got more votes than all other books combined. All right, that's a serious statement, and that's a terrible statement. So I think that things like that do make a difference. But I also think that Americans tend to credit historical sites. I mean, you read a historic marker put up by the state of Illinois or you see a monument, or you go to a historic house that is now a museum. And I don't think that most people think that that site is lying to you. And, of course, that's why I wrote my new book, Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong.
I should probably introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with James Loewen. He is the author of the books that we mentioned, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, and the more recent Lies Across America, What Our Historic Markers and Monuments Get Wrong. And he's here spending some time in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall on the U of I campus. And when we heard he was going to be here, we said, yes, let's have him come back on the program. We could talk some more about history and teaching his history and so forth. And if you have questions or comments, maybe you'd like to tell us about some of your experiences as a student of history, you can give us a call. In a second here, we'll talk a little bit about the next step from Lies Across America, which is looking for monuments and markers that got it right. And he is interested in suggestions, things that he might look at, not just in Illinois, but any place else that you might be aware of, that would then become probably another book. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere. You can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champaign, line number one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I had similar experience in high school.
Hold on a second.
I'm
We're
not getting anything.
You're not getting anything. Well. Okay. Try a different pair of headphones. How about trying these? Pardon me for the interruption there, but yep. you started peeking, and Mr. Loewen said he couldn't hear. We got you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had similar experience in high school where, you know, really atrocious. Looked nice, but, you know, in terms of what was actually in the textbook, pretty bad. And, you know, even though the teacher was a full-time history teacher and didn't coach teams or anything like that, still had us, you know, answer all these stupid questions at the end of the chapters. In fact, I didn't really read what I'd call a good history book until I was, you know, like even out of college and read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. But I was lucky enough to have a good history teacher my senior year, who exposed us to some films and other things that, had the responses of people like Smedley Butler. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his full name now. But anyway.
You got it. That's it.
Yeah, okay. who basically was explaining mm-hmm. what our real foreign policy in Latin America was and things like that, you know, so that even though it wasn't in the textbooks, at least we're exposed to a little bit of the other side. And this was at the height of the Vietnam War. And looked at you know, some of the history of our involvement in Vietnam and how, we stopped the elections, because we didn't want Ho Chi Minh to come to power. Things like that. So, in that respect, I was quite lucky, but it wasn't because of the textbooks that the school system had approved.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And in fact, the textbook publishers haven't made much changes, at least that I've found, since my book came out. But a lot of teachers have. That is, Lies My Teacher Told Me has sold almost 400,000 copies now, and a lot of those copies have been bought by teachers. And they are teaching differently. And so an increasing number are teaching like the person you had your senior year. And something that makes that easier is the web. Because suddenly now, even if you're in a out-of-the-way, all-white town like Mahomet, or wherever you are, Buffalo, Illinois, a town that's so small that it doesn't have a significant library in the high school, you suddenly have a library of several million historic sources if you have a modem, if you're connected to the web. And so there's really no excuse anymore for teachers to teach only from the textbook. And even if the textbook is terrible and full of inaccuracies, that doesn't even upset me, so long as the classroom is full of other resources and the students are encouraged to check out the textbook rather than just to memorize it.
How much pressure do you think there is still today? I mean, I think it was pretty strong back in the 1960s when I was in high school, but, you know, today, basically, you know, to whitewash American history. And, you know, I mean, do teachers get sat on or threatened?
I don't think they do too much, but they think they do. That is to say, I've found that teachers are of two types. One group of teachers has done something. Something interesting. I'll just give you an example that will stand for that class. There's a 6th or 7th grade teacher in Amherst Middle School in Amherst, Massachusetts, who for the last 4 or 5 years has had his students put Lord Jeffrey Amherst on trial for the crime of genocide. Now, that's a controversial thing to do in Amherst, Massachusetts, where the town is named for him. And in fact, the town is named for him because he did do it. That is, he gave small, or he had his subalterns give smallpox infected blankets to the Indians, caused an epidemic of smallpox amongst them, and thereby won Pontiac's rebellion. Well, by a margin of about 20 to 10 in the first year, his students found him guilty. And I thought that was charming because it shows that the students do have intellectual freedom. They can come out either way they want on the issue. But that's a controversial issue. He's doing fine. He gets reappointed. But then the majority of teachers, I think, shy away from ever trying this kind of thing because they worry, will they get parental complaints? Will their principals back them up? And as long as they worry about it, they don't do it. And as long as they don't do it, they don't get any parental complaints. And so they think they're doing the right thing, but they haven't tried.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Let's go to another caller here. We have somebody on car phone, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the speaker, for being there, and for having this program. I came in late. I don't know if you've addressed this issue, but I was wondering if you have discussed some of the major inaccuracies in historic films or stuff that comes out of Hollywood.
I haven't done that because I've got my hands full dealing with what's on the landscape and what's in the classroom. But other people have, and there's a terrific book called Past Imperfect, edited by a guy named Mark Carnes, C-A-R-N-E-S, it's actually treats 50 different films, and he has recruited 50 different authors to deal with them. And just to give you an indication of the quality of the authors he's recruited, for Jurassic Park, because he starts way back, he has Stephen Jay Gould talking about it. For Glory, the film about black soldiers in the Civil War, he has James McPherson, author of the famous book Battle Cry of Freedom, A History of the Civil War. So I think that topic has been kind of covered by that guy, and so I'm not doing it.
Excellent. I'll look it up. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, we'll go next to line number 2, and this is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of observations. One of them was that I took American history shortly after World War II, in which I was involved, and our text was entitled A Short History of American Democracy. And, of course, at that time, the idea was to extol the importance and the virtues of American democracy. But I had a wonderful teacher who did quite a bit of corrective teaching in spite of the text we had. I wanted to ask you how you feel about the People's History of the United States by Zinn. I just started reading it, and I frankly can't bring myself to read too much of it at a time. It's just too darn depressing.
Well, try my book. It'll depress you even more.
Oh, really?
No, maybe not. I like much of People's History of the United States. And, in fact, some people do confuse me and Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn, who's the author of People's History of the United States, he has a blurb that the publisher in its infinite wisdom put on the cover of my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, in which he says something like, every student, every citizen should read this book, meaning my book. So there's actually been at least one person who bought my book thinking it was by Zinn because they noticed Zinn's title up on the Zinn's name up on the front of the book.
I see.
And conversely, Howard and I, we don't know each other well, but we do email each other. And when I told him that by email, he emailed me back and said the other day he was speaking someplace and somebody came up afterward and said, I really love your work, especially your book Lies My Teacher Told Me. But they're not identical works by any means. We have a very similar take, for instance, on Columbus. And what's what Columbus really was doing and what's important about Columbus, which usually gets systematically left out of American history textbooks.
That's one of the most depressing
yes, it is.
I've ever read. So.
But we have a rather different take on, for example, the American Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And so you'll find, I think, that Zinn is somewhat more cynical and a little more conspiratorial than I am. I think there's some wonderful things in the American past. And if we treat it all as wonderful and Pollyanna, then nobody's going to believe us when we say that anything was wonderful. So I think we have to tell the history, warts and all, but it isn't all warts.
One of the inferences that I drew from my course was that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments of the Constitution were really intended essentially as punitive measures rather than constructive measures.
And that's an outrage. I think, well, I argue in my new book particularly, Lies Across America, that between about 1890 and 1925, the Confederacy won the Civil War. Now, I do know that it ended in 1865.
Uh-huh.
But between 1890 and 1925, the Confederates, or the neo-Confederates we might call them, first of all, got to rename it. And it no longer became the Civil War. It was the War Between the States, which nobody called it while it was being fought.
Mm-hmm.
Second, they got to define what it was about. And it suddenly became about states' rights. And I asked just recently, this week at the University of Illinois, all kinds of students think it was about states' rights in the year 2000. Well, it wasn't. And I flatly disproved that in Lies Across America. But that's what the Confederate or the neo-Confederates got us to believe. And so there's so many distortions, and one of them then is about Republican policies like the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which basically were treated between 1890 and 1925 solely as either punitive or else as political opportunism in order to delude the blacks to vote Republican. That's not true. There was a lot of idealism. A lot of people during the Reconstruction era and even after it for some decades believed that blacks should have equal rights and tried to get them. And so I think we have a really inadequate understanding of such Illinois leaders as Lincoln, even on this point,
uh-huh.
Grant and Logan.
Uh-huh. How do you feel about the Charles and Mary Beard theory that the Civil War was really the revolt of the North against the South? The industrial, you know, trying to get out from under the agriculture domination.
If that's exactly what they say, and I did read their economic interpretation but a long time ago, and I can't remember that they said that. But if that's what they say, I don't think much about it at all.
Uh-huh.
Because we do have to remember it was the South that seceded.
Yes.
And I think the South seceded partly because when Lincoln came to power, for the first time in more than a decade, they did not control the federal government. And so in order to maintain the supremacy of slavery forever, and this is why they say they seceded. You know, we can actually go on the web and you can download the South Carolina Declaration of Independence and read it, and they say why they seceded, and it had nothing to do with that Beard thesis.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
sure.
Thank you. We are a bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is James Loewen. He's written a couple of interesting books about American history and what we know and what we don't. His books are Lies My Teacher Told Me, which looks at high school history textbooks and what they get wrong. His most recent one, actually, we talked about in this program not very long ago, Lies Across America, What Our Historic Markers and Monuments Get Wrong. He's spending some time on the U of I campus, and we asked him if he would just come in and talk about some of these things with us, and he said sure he would. The number, by the way, if you'd like to call in, and we have several people, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Champagne is next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling. I'm a teacher over here at Home High School in Urbana. I have a very curious group of 7th and 8th graders who wanted me to call and ask you if you could give some examples of really flagrantly bad historical markers in Illinois or in our area that we might go check out.
Huh. You know, I actually can't in terms of this area. I did read all of the historical markers in Illinois, but I read them really fast, and I read them several years ago. My book, Lies Across America, has at least one entry, one site, historic site, that's wrong in every state. And I have one in Illinois, but it's up in Chicago. It is the Haymarket Monument, and I tell the incredible history that it's been through. And this is not to say, then, that there aren't some historical markers nearby that aren't wrong. There probably are. Let me give you an example, though, that's in Indiana, not too far away. And it'll give you an idea of the kind of problem that historical markers have. The state of Indiana has only one historical marker that treats white women, and it is kind of ridiculous in itself. It treats a woman who had her ovary out when she lived in Kentucky, and she then became old and moved into Indiana to live with her son. And she gets a historical marker in Indiana for that. In other words, she came into the state of Indiana minus a body part. Well, this is not exactly a feminist marker, shall we say. It implies that there was never a white woman who did anything in Indiana, which is ridiculous. And so in my book, Lies Across America, I point out three different women in Indiana history who get no historical markers, but who did do important things, one of whom even was Amelia Earhart, for heaven's sakes. But the marker I want to bring to the attention of you and your students, and this is a common problem, and it's a common problem in Illinois. By the way, I think Illinois has only one historical marker for a woman, if that.
And that's significant to us because we're an all-girls school.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well, listen to this marker. This is in Boone County, Indiana, and it goes like this. Patrick H. Sullivan, 1794-1879, was the first white settler in Boone County, 1823, and built the first log cabin. Now, it turns out that if you do a little research on Patrick H. Sullivan, you find out that he actually came into Boone County with his wife and two-year-old kid. Now, how could he then be the first white settler? Did he lean forward in the wagon when it crossed the county line so he breasted the tape first? I don't think so. They just leave out Ms. Sullivan. And I'll tell you something else. I've worked with logs in the state of Vermont. I heated my house with wood for 20 years. And the first thing you need when you are building a log cabin is you need somebody on the other end of the log. So there's no possibility that he built the first log cabin while she sat on a stump knitting doilies, or whatever you do with doilies, I'm not quite sure. They built the first log cabin. And I think it makes a difference because I think even in this era when women are playing college sports fully and so on, we still don't think of women as people who handled logs, who were pioneers in that sense. But they were. And one of the reasons we don't think of them that way is because the landscape makes us stupid by leaving them out.
So you're saying there's only one historical marker to women in all of Illinois?
I think so.
Well, maybe we'll have to do something about that.
I think that would be a great project.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go again. We have another car phone person here, line three. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
This is Dave on a car phone, actually a truck phone, and it's very interesting. As to the markers for women, there is a non-governmental marker to Mother Jones in southern Illinois.
Yes, there is. That's a good point. It's a terrific monument, really.
Yep.
I think she is buried there. It's in Verdon, is it not?
Yes.
And
it's not official.
That's true. It's not an official state historical marker, but it does tell the story of Mother Jones and of the labor movement in the mines in that area.
Right. Most dangerous woman in America at one time, they said.
And she got a magazine named after her.
That's right. Would you care to speak to the real problem, and that's corporate sponsorship of textbooks and corporate ownership of textbook publishers? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. I actually don't think that's the real problem, and I'll tell you why. I think that corporate sponsors of textbooks, and I'm not in favor of the huge amalgamations we have now, in which something like 85% of all books published in America are published by five companies. But despite that, I think most textbook publishers would publish a good textbook if they thought it would make money. And we have to remember, for instance, Random House, I think it was, published Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book, which is an anti-capitalist book. And my books, Lies Across America and Lies My Teacher Told Me, are published in paperback by Simon & Schuster, which is related to the same conglomerate that publishes many of the textbooks. Why do they publish? Well, I'll give you a specific example. The acquisitions editor at Simon & Schuster, who bought Lies My Teacher Told Me in paperback, and they bid a bunch of money for it, too. She was delighted with the fact that they got it, and she was delighted with the fact, as she told me, that the previous book she got was The Bell Curve. Now, The Bell Curve is a very different kind of book from mine, and this implies to me that she's going to buy any book that she thinks they're going to make a buck off of. And Simon & Schuster has made lots of money off my book because it keeps on selling so well. So I think I could probably write a book called The Corporate Structure in America and Why It Sucks and is Screwing the Country And they would publish it if they thought they would make money off of it. So I don't really think that's the key problem. And in fact, in Lies My Teacher Told Me, in Chapter 11, I do describe at great length why I think the books are so bad and why so many teachers teach from them, even though they are so bad.
All right, let's go again to Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. You know, there is a huge distortion of history, which has been perpetrated by our schools and now has been even institutionalized by our courts. And that distortion is our – people think that our Constitution prohibits public religious expression, especially in our public schools, based on no constitutional provision at all, but based on an obscure letter written by Thomas Jefferson. And what is interesting is that in several very important legal decisions, judges have commented on the fact that this supposed separation of church and state doesn't exist, but people keep acting as if it does exist. One of the first very interesting comments was made by a judge, Judge Albert Gallagher. Now, he was a justice of the New York Supreme Court, and a case was brought before that court about a nativity scene on a school lawn. And so Judge Albert Gallagher wrote the opinion, and here's just a brief paragraph about what he wrote. By the way, this idea of separation of church and state is based on an obscure letter written by Thomas Jefferson, and Judge Gallagher mentions that letter. He says much has been written in recent years concerning Thomas Jefferson's reference in 1802 to a wall of separation between church and state. It is upon that wall that plaintiffs seek to build their case. Jefferson's figure of speech has received so much attention that one would almost think at times that it was to be found somewhere in our Constitution. Courts and authors have devoted numerous pages to its interpretation. This court has no intention of engaging in a dispute among historians as to the meaning of a metaphor. The only language which we are called upon to interpret and apply is the plain language quoted above from the federal and state constitutions. And, of course, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court, he wrote a dissent in the 1985 case of Wallace versus Jaffe, in which he also commented that the separation of church and state did not exist. He called it the wall of separation. He said it wasn't found in history. He said it was based on bad history, and he said it should be frankly and explicitly abandoned. But I think that most people still think that wall of separation exists and have probably been taught that it exists in their schools.
Well, that's a complicated question, and I think I don't want to go way into it. I would point out that Rehnquist was in dissent, so obviously there were a bunch of folks who didn't exactly agree with him. I think what we've got in this country is a lot of people haven't really thought out the fact that in a given community, for instance, this recent Texas case where the school board and the team clearly sanctioned and were fired up for a public Christian prayer before each a Protestant Christian prayer before each football game, that is kind of moving towards and unconstitutionally towards, according to the courts, a state establishment of religion. And what people don't realize is that with our increasing in-migration, there are whole areas of the United States, or whole towns anyway, where a school district might be majority Muslim or might be majority Jewish, and Baptists in that area or might be majority Catholic and going to public school. And let's say Baptists in that area won't be and wouldn't be so excited to have the entire football audience grind to a halt while at the beginning of the game a prayer to Allah or a Jewish prayer or a Catholic prayer is uttered up officially by the school system sanctioned folks. So I think you are right in that the judges have sometimes gone too far and said, well, we can't even have a religious club operating on school property. Well, of course you can. You can have all of the religious clubs, but you can't have one religion favored above and at the expense of others. And I think there is pretty good jurisprudence on that, including, of course, the Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of it, which is what the Constitution actually says. Mm.
We have just about 5 minutes left. We have some other callers. I hope, again, the caller will bear with me if I want to go on. Let's go to Belgium, line number one. Hello?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to the monuments that the gentleman spoke about. One of the most interesting monuments I've ever come across is in the middle of Kentucky. It's as large as the Washington Monument, but it's been put there, and it looks just like the Washington Monument for the most part, but it's been put there for Jefferson Davis,
yes,
which is the founding father of the Confederacy. And I think that must be his hometown or something nearby.
It's his hometown county, that's right.
Yes. I've found that because you can see it for miles away.
Right.
And I don't think very many people ever go see it, do they?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
and in fact, I treat it in my new book, Lies Across America.
Ah.
Lies Across America has 100 short chapters, and one of them treats Confederate monuments. And I actually locate that chapter in Helena, Montana, where there's a Confederate memorial to our beloved Confederate dead, which is fairly hilarious because, of course, Helena, Montana never had any Confederate dead. It never even had any Union dead because there was no Montana during the Civil War. But this didn't stop the good ladies of the United Daughters of the Confederacy from putting up a monument to them. And that's they were the folks who started the monument you're talking about in Todd County, Kentucky. And I argue that this monument in Kentucky does make a difference, that it helps make folks, even today, Confederate in their hearts and minds. And I think I prove it. And so maybe listeners would like to look at that. I would point out that Abraham Lincoln said during the Civil War, I would like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky. And he held Kentucky. And in fact, Kentucky did send 35,000 troops to the Confederate Army, but it sent 90,000 troops to the United States Army, and it did not secede. Today, Kentucky has 74 Civil War monuments. Two of them are for the U.S., and 72 of them, including the one you mentioned, are for the Confederate states. And so the Confederate states now hold Kentucky, which they could not hold during the Civil War. And I think it makes an unfortunate difference.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. You know, one of the things that I sort of said I'd like to have you do, and unfortunately now we don't really have very much time, is to talk a little bit about monuments where they got it.
Yeah.
Right, and which is now you're, after having done Lies Across America, you're interested in finding good ones. Is there any, are there any that sort of stand out in your mind?
Sure, and let me invite listeners who have an idea of a monument that they think gets things right to email me. And my email address, and I know radio, I'll give it twice. My email address is jlowen, and that's J-L-O-E-W-E-N, jlowen, @ zoo, Z-O-O, dot UVM, as in the University of Vermont. I'm not there anymore, but my email is, .edu. So it's jlowen @zoo.uvm.edu. And I'd love to hear from you about a monument or marker or historic site of any kind that you think tells a difficult and complex story and tells it thoroughly and complexly and does a good job. And I have several of them in mind in Illinois. Actually, and one of them, for instance, is a school and an obelisk in front of it in southwestern Illinois, the Silas Hamilton School in the tiny little town of Otterville, Illinois. And this is a school put up by a white plantation owner in Mississippi who gave up slave owning in Mississippi, moved to Illinois. Well, actually, he moved from Vermont. It's a long story, but he had this plantation in Mississippi. Freed his slaves, and one of them in particular, who was a young kid when he adopted him, more or less, named George Washington, not that George Washington, ended up living in this area until his entire life, became a successful farmer, and helped endow the school. And so this school, which was an interracial school set up for George Washington's education as well as for white kids' education, was the school in the community until not too long ago. And now it's in some disrepair and needs some work. And it has this obelisk that was put up by George Washington in honor of and in memory of his slave owner because his slave owner stopped owning him. And so it's the only statement on the entire American landscape that I know of that is about a plantation owner but is put up by an African-American rather than a white. And it's really quite a story. So I'm looking for stories like that, not necessarily about race relations and not necessarily in Illinois. And so if you've got some for me, please email me.
We'll try to get one more caller real quick here. Aurora, Line 3, hello.
Yes, my 9-year-old granddaughter can no longer say this Pledge of Allegiance in the schools. Isn't there some way they can have some kind of allegiance to, so young people know what their allegiance to without the word God in it?
Why can't she say it? Because
what?
She's not a believer in God?
I mean, they don't say any Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh. Well, in many places, not only is the Pledge of Allegiance still said, but furthermore, I have it's a wonderful batch of emails from a student who emailed me as follows several years ago. He said, "Dear Mr. Lowen, I really like your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. I've been using it to heckle my teacher from the back of the room." This is a hilarious high school student. He says, "Furthermore, my friends like it, and if I could get a group price on it from Simon & Schuster, I could sell it in the corridors of my high school." So I sent off his email to Simon & Schuster, got it back a couple of days later with a group price, sent it off to him, and I heard back from him, "Dear Mr. Lowen, thank you very much for the group price. However, I have to put my plans on selling your book in my high school on hold because tomorrow I'm getting expelled for failing to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance." So he didn't want to say it, and he was coerced into saying it and was expelled for not saying it. So I'm not aware of very many places where you cannot say it. I would say, again, it shouldn't be the school's business one way or the other. And, of course, the Under God clause got put in during the Eisenhower administration very late. It wasn't part of the Pledge of Allegiance until about 1954, right in the middle of the McCarthy era, when we wanted to claim that God was on our side in the Cold War. And I do think there's a problem with coercing people like my emailer who don't believe in God, but who are forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance and to stand up for it, even though it says we are one nation under God. And I might point out that this is not a Swedish view of the world. In other words, Sweden doesn't think that God is on our side and not theirs. Kenya doesn't think God is on our side and not theirs. So I think this is kind of a silly addition to the Pledge of Allegiance that tends to make us ethnocentric and convinced that God is on our side.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. Our guest, James Lowen, look for his books. I'm sure you can find them in the bookstore at the library, Lies My Teacher Told Me and Lies Across America. Thanks very much.